Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's June 1st, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast there is. I'm Kelly Ripa.
And I'm Regis Philbin.
Well, I'm starting to feel like Kelly Ripa these days. I mean, we're trying out all these hosts while Scott's gallivanting all over the world. And, of course, my name is Chris Cosenza, and this week we have the awesome Lee Childs filling in admirably for Scott Long. Lee, how's it going?
It's going great, man. Getting ready for the series. Getting excited.
You know, I don't know if you listened to last week's show, but, we talked a little bit about how certain people feel like unless they've, contributed to something, then that actual event hasn't happened yet. And that's sort of Scott Long's take on this. You know, he had to call in last week to let us know that Faso was filling in, even though we had already said Faso was filling in. And, you know, of course, this week is no different. Scott had a little hit to his ego this week when he found out that the people that he talked to on his trip said that the show with Faso was probably the best show ever. Scott didn't like that, so he had to call in and get his own two cents in. So here's Scott's call.
The great group of guys that came out for the Minneapolis meetup said, "Hey, last week's show was awesome with Faso. I got to admit, I think it's actually even better with Faso than you will." So obviously here at Ante Up, we want to do the best for our listeners. So when I get back to the office, we're going to send Chris on a top-secret clandestine trip to Somalia, and then Faso and I will co-host, and that show is going to be even better than last week's show. So have a good week this week with Lee, and I will be back next week.
So Scott wants to send me to Somalia so he can have a better show. You know, what's the deal here? Do you think I never really pegged Scott as an egomaniac, but I tell you, lately he just can't let go of it. He doesn't think the show happens unless his voice is heard on it somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people think you're the egomaniac, but he's definitely in the closet with that for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like he thinks that these people are clamoring for him and, like, threatening to boycott the show unless he's on or something. You know, we'll do okay without you, buddy. Just enjoy your little jaunt across the Midwest, you know?
Yeah, I was really nervous about being on here, Chris, because I really like Scott, and I just, I'm afraid he's going to lose his job. So, you know, I mean, I guess you could still keep him around for, you know, selling ads and writing some stuff or whatever. But
or whatever it is that he does. We're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I don't know.
But, well, we are definitely happy to have you on board this week. And we know that you obviously have some big plans for the World Series and that you're going to be going out there pretty soon. So we're glad we got you when we did. When are you going, and what do you think the World Series is going to look like for you this year?
Oh, I'm really excited this year. This is probably the most excited I've been in a while about going out there. I've been playing a lot more live, obviously, with the state of online poker, and you know it's been great for me just to get so much live experience in the past few months. So I'm feeling really confident about my game. I'm actually heading out tomorrow, and I'll be kicking it off this weekend in event number 9, which is a $1,500 re-entry. There's two starting days, and you can re-enter on Sunday if you bust day one. But you know, this is I've made a lot of changes to my game based on just, you know, some of my own work and obviously with all the training and stuff that I've been doing. And I'm really confident going into this series. Looking forward to getting out there.
Now, when you talk about, the re-entry, is that something that you'd consider if, God forbid, you get knocked out on the first day, or do you just let it go?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime that I'm playing a re-entry event, I go ahead and budget for that.
Okay.
I'm not going to just take one shot at a tournament like that. You know, and the way to look at it is, you know, if you were going to play a $1,500 event with, you know, whatever the prize pool will be in that, you know, you should, and if they were holding one the next day with the same huge prize pool, then you would obviously want to play that. So I just consider it a totally new tournament.
You know, we had some changes to the World Series this year, and one of them that was pretty popular with a lot of the players was the whole you can talk to the your opponent now and whatever, talk during the hand and things like that. Now, does that play a big role in your game? Because I know when you're on our cruises and stuff and you're playing, I hear you talking a lot, but a lot of times it's just after hands, not usually during hands. Is that part of your game?
Yeah, you know, it's gradually become more and more part of my game. Playing so much live lately, you know, there's been a lot of spots that I can pinpoint, and just in recent tournaments where, you know, I've talked after the hand because these rules weren't in place and you couldn't really discuss it. And, you know, and it, just some of the reactions you get out of people. You know, I was playing at the circuit in Pennsylvania, and after the hand, the guy had bluffed, and I almost called him down with ace high. And as soon as I mucked, I had the chips in my hand, I was ready. And after I went ahead and mucked, and as he mucked and took in the pot, I said, Jack 10? And he just laughed. He goes, yep, clubs. Like right away, like his reaction was just so genuine. He goes, I wouldn't have said anything, but since you nailed it, it's like, yeah, I had Jack 10 of clubs. And so had I been able to say something during the hand, I'm pretty sure I would have gotten the reaction that I needed out of him, because he would have been caught off guard. So, you know, I think that's something that, you know, in years past, you know, I wouldn't have used it as much because I was, you know, so used to playing online, and that's where a lot of my prep was. Even though I've always played a lot live, we just didn't have that ability, and you know, to talk about the hands that I wasn't as comfortable. But now I think it's gonna really help a lot of players that have a lot of live experience.
So now, is that something that, you know, you would, now here's the deal: you have you know, a lot of training that you do on your own, but you also do, you know, inside the mines with a lot of your, you know, you have a couple of your friends that you're doing it with, the really good players and stuff. Is that stuff too now that you start talking about with friends and fellow players about what to say at particular moments? Or is that stuff that you're gleaning off of other people when you're sitting at a table and saying, wow, that was a really good comment to make to get that information? Is that something you sort of put in your Rolodex?
Yeah, I've definitely learned a lot from some of the, you know, other really good players that I've played with. I haven't used it specifically in my training, but I will going forward now that we have this rule in place. But I've only done a couple of sessions since, really only one session since I heard about the rule change. And, you know, just the stuff we were working on wasn't specific to that. And the players weren't specific, you know, there was only a couple going out for the series. But it's, and I'm telling you, just from not only the talking standpoint, but, you know, it's something that people need to do when you're sitting in these tournaments and you've got good players at your table. Just watch what they're doing, you know, and how they're betting. I've picked up a lot of things recently. I was deep in an event at Parks in near Philly and playing with a few good players, and I just started watching what they were doing and started putting some of those things into my game. And it's, you know, it's something that we all need to do, and not get caught up just in our own game, but when we're out of the hands, you know, paying attention to what people are doing, and now obviously what they're saying. And I've got some good friends that are great talkers, and I think they're going to have a pretty big series.
You know, all the times that you and I have seen each other out in Vegas during the World Series and stuff, I don't think I've ever seen you play cash games. Do you play a lot of cash games when you're out there, or are you just so focused on the tournament thing?
Last year I played quite a bit because online poker had gone away, and what I used to do was, you know, if I was out of a tournament, I would just, if I was going to continue playing, I would either, you know, play something else like one of the dailies, or I would go and play online, you know, especially if it was a Sunday. But last year I played quite a bit of cash, and I actually think it kind of hurt my game in both respects. You know, cash games and tournaments are so different, and, you know, I know those differences, I teach those differences, but I wasn't doing well myself adjusting, and it kind of hurt me. So I quit playing cash and just focused on tournaments the latter half of the summer, and, you know, and it really helped me. So this year I will probably not really play any cash while I'm out there, and just really focus on the tournaments. I've got a pretty good schedule put together that I'm really comfortable with, and, you know, I have tournaments planned for every day. Obviously I hope to play about half of them. Wow. But, you know, I'll be I've got, I think it's about 21 tournaments, which includes World Series events and Venetian events. even a couple of the daily deep stacks I've got on the schedule, just days where I'll likely be off from a main event.
So you brought up the cash games. One of the things that I think we've talked about with you in the past was not necessarily playing like say a 5-10 when you know you could crush a 2-5, but when you're out in Vegas during the World Series, it's such a crazy place. It's a madhouse that a lot of times you're just happy to be sitting at a table because the lists are so long to accommodate you to actually get in on a cash game. Was that something that you were like might have contributed to some of the problems that you were having? Was the fact that you basically had to sit wherever they made you sit, or and you didn't want to get into playing the games you wanted to play, or was it just the overall busyness of the events?
Well, you know, once you final table the main event, you just go and sit wherever you want. You ask people to get up and take things. No, yeah, you know, it's. I think there were a couple of times where I did just get at a table and maybe didn't request a seat change or didn't request a table change. There were times where I was real focused on that after I'd been not doing so well. So that can play into it. But the other thing is, those games, like if you've got the bankroll, the 5-10 game with no cap there is a really great game to play. And, the cash, I've got some friends that are going and they're pretty much only playing cash out there because it's just so lucrative. And, and I think maybe eventually down the road, I'll probably start playing a little more cash and, a little less, fewer tournaments. But yeah, the games are great. And you just have to make sure you're practicing the right game selection based on your bankroll. And then, sometimes you're going to get in a game where it's just kind of tough. You've actually got several good players and need to make sure you're changing tables to find the right ones. But, I didn't think the waits were too bad, and that's one thing that a lot of people, they bust out and then they get, they're itching to still play. So they go and straight from a tournament straight to the cash game or to a sit and go. And you have to give yourself time to kind of decompress and realize you're going into a totally different game, and make sure you've got your mind right. That's something I actually just talked about a lot in my last class because, everybody just wants to play while they're out there. And they don't take enough breaks and they're jumping from one completely different game to another. And I think that's a big mistake. So, I've even had that happen with tournaments. I was down in Palm Beach and had made the second day of the 1K, and we started real early, which was the same day as the main event. And when I went out in sixth place and went straight and late registered for the main event, so I go from final table, huge annies, pretty much every decision is push fold, to now, lots of, small ball preflop, no annies, and it's just a totally different game, and I wished after the fact that I had just taken some time.
So we talked a little bit about some of the changes at the World Series, and we got an item this week from our Vegas correspondent, Todd Lomansky, who is dealing the World Series this year. He let us know, obviously people know about it now because the event's been going on, but he let us know before the World Series even started that dealers in the World Series gold bracelet events will be required to use an electronic tablet device that will be in their dealer box to help track the event in real time. What do you think about this? If we are being honest, there are people dealing in the World Series that are very inexperienced. They're basically, some of them, deal like, bar leagues and stuff like that, and then they're just showing up and passing the training to get in. I mean, this is the World Series. The last thing you want is to be even more distracted. I think it's more of a crutch, but something that can hurt them. When they're really looking to just be focused on what they're doing. So have you heard about this yet?
I heard about it from you, and I was looking it up. From the first link I found, it says they're going to use it to check in the players when they arrive and remove the busted players, update chip counts, but only on breaks, and to call the floor. So if those are the main things that they're doing, I don't think it'll be a huge problem because – sometimes it takes a while to get the floor there. So if there's a way to get the floors quicker, that's great. And checking in players, as long as they have their routine down, because, you're right that, there are some pretty inexperienced dealers. And you run into that everywhere these days. And, it's kind of hit or miss. But, I've found that, the World Series circuit dealers and the ones, they put them through that training out there, that for the most part, I think they're usually pretty good. You know, I've had very few problems out there. I think I've had more problems in other places. You know, and there are some, you know, there's a ton of really, really great dealers, you know, like the ones that Jody's brought on the cruise. I remember that first one where we had, what, 8 dealers and 6 of them had dealt the final table to main event.
Yeah, it was,
you know,
pretty crazy.
And they're just phenomenal, you know. So, yeah, it was just, hopefully it'll be okay. You know, that's going to be interesting to see. I'll definitely keep you updated on what I think about that once I'm there.
Yeah, I mean, as long as their involvement with this is minimal and they're doing it at intervals when it doesn't distract from their main task, which is dealing cards and keeping track of pots and things like that, that's cool. And it sounds like most of it's going to be that done. But like when somebody gets busted out or, you know, I mean, it's like, really, you want to take another couple of seconds here to open up the tablet and make sure it's working properly? Oh, wait, it's not charged. You know, who knows what the... You know, you can just imagine there's going to be some sort of issue that someone's going to complain about. And
yeah, sure. But I haven't been following real closely. Just, you know, there's only been the one no-limit event so far. But I haven't, from what I have been following, I haven't seen complaints. You know, but the other thing is if they're updating when people get there and when they bust, that should, you know, help keep the tables getting filled quicker too, and rather than relying on the floor to pick up the seat cards, which maybe they're still doing. I guess they'd have to still use the seat cards. They probably couldn't just jump all electronic to start.
You know, listen, the blinds are going up in a couple minutes. Don't worry about saying who got knocked out right now. Just deal my big blind so I don't have to pay a bigger.
Right.
You know. Oh, man. All right, so what events can you clue us into some of the – are there any interesting events that you're playing? Are they all no limit? Are you trying to spread out a little bit more this year?
Playing all no limit this year. Uh-huh. And playing 1Ks to 3Ks other than the main event. That'll be the only 10K that I play. And, you know, of course, depending on how the summer starts off, you know, I could potentially put in a 5K in there as far as no limit. But, you know, the 5K events, they're usually the toughest tournaments, and I'm trying to be really good with the game selection this year.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot of these events that are really just kind of ego fest, you know, and so like some of the heads up, and, you know, and it's great. I mean, it's a great challenge, and, you know, there's the 5K mix max that, you know, is 9-handed to start, then 6-handed day 2, and
right.
then it's heads up, which is pretty cool. But, you know, it's going to be it's a smaller, tougher field, you know. So I'm mainly playing, you know, I will play the, I think there's a 3K 6 max, which, you know, 6-handed event I'm really looking forward to. I love those events. I love having room at the table and just, you know, and it gives you've got a lot more action. Plus, being a 3K, you know, we'll start with 9,000 chips. So, good structure. I'm not planning on playing the 4-handed event. There's a 2,500 4-handed that's really interesting. That's one that I may consider if the summer's, you know, going pretty well. But I think I have a Venetian tournament that day and scheduled. So, and then the Venetian ones, it's 1Ks up to the 2,500s. And I'm not, as of right now, I'm not planning on playing the 5K main. But I guess the other one that's interesting that I'm really looking forward to is that ante-only tournament.
Oh, yeah.
The 1,500 ante-only, so that'll be interesting.
Are you staying straight through, or are you coming home in between? How are you working it?
Yeah, I'm going to make a couple of trips. Heading out, then be back around Father's Day weekend, and then I'll come back for a little bit before the main event.
All right, so will you be there when we're there? We're there the 25th to the 29th.
Yep, I'll definitely be there.
Okay,
yep.
Cool. All right, so our hotline is 813-448-1120. If you call it and we use it, we might give you something pretty cool. Let's hear. This clip comes from Lauren, a longtime listener, and a couple of times I played in home games with him, and a real good player, but he's got an interesting question for us.
Hey, guys, it's Lauren calling from New York, and I was wondering if you could maybe cover a topic that has come up for me lately. Is playing online for free money wrecking our poker skills? I missed playing online a lot, so I started playing on Zynga. And in the cash games, no matter what the stakes, everyone is shoving all the time. It's always a coin flip. And in the tournaments, they're just so desperately bad, it's not even funny. So it's fun to, you know, play and win, but I'm afraid that I'm totally wrecking my abilities to play real poker when actual real money poker comes back. So do you guys have any thoughts or any advice for how to keep your real skills up when you're playing against those players? Okay, thanks, bye.
Okay, I actually have some thoughts on this, and it probably isn't exactly what he's doing, but for me, you know, I play a lot with my family on the weekends. They think of it as a social thing, and so do I. I just want to be able to spend time with my family, parents especially. So when I play with them, you know, I literally am not making moves. I am not really bluffing, because it's ABC poker, and it has to be. And I just have to keep the mindset that I just don't care about it, that I'm just having fun seeing what kinds of combinations of flops and hands get made and things like that, and the nuances of the ABC player, or even, you know, if they're even categorized as that. But when I play with my family, I think it's the same type of competition that he'd be facing at Zynga, and I think that really you just have to go into it with the mindset that I'm not losing money, I'm not getting better by playing this, and I should just have fun, enjoy myself, and just see exactly what these people play like, so when I do encounter this type of player in the real world, I'll know how to play against them. But I don't know if it makes your skills erode. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I used to play some of the free rolls they used to do online for the World Series, you know, and they were always crazy. The first hand, there'd be seven or eight people all in, and you know, and I've always recommended to people, you know, when they've asked students and friends, whoever, that poker's a game designed to be played for something. So when it is free, it's not going to, you know, really be a true game, but you know, and you do have to play very differently if you actually want to work on your game. But you know, I think what you can use it for is you know, kind of adjusting to some of the smaller tournaments that you'll play and smaller cash games where you just don't have all the different tools at your disposal. You know, you got to make a lot of pre-flop decisions based on effective stack sizes, and you know, and so if people are just shoving pre-flop, then obviously you have to adjust your calling ranges, and sometimes you're actually going to have to widen them a little bit because you know that they're just playing crazy. But you know, I think that you've got to, you know, use it as, like you said, it's really just for your entertainment. If it's completely free, you know, I've heard a lot of people playing in some of these sites where they have, you know, staking packages that can be won, and so they're actually playing for some type of real monetary value. And as long as you're playing for something, you know, the play is going to be a little bit more reasonable, and you should be able to play. But you know, if it's simply just for points and free chips that you can just reload, then you know, you're not going to be able to really work on your game and not really work on your post flop play, because people just, you know, come in with a king deuce and see it all the way to the river, whether they have anything, you know, and you know, just it's just not really going to help you that much. So I think if you find something where you know, actually have something to play for, then it can be useful. But other than that, I think it's just, you know, something for entertainment to kill time, like any other game on your iPad or online.
And I guess the one thing that I could extract from it is basically using it as a challenge. And in that case, just, you know, really try to figure out how to beat these people, you know, or to beat these types of players, and then put that in your Rolodex or your arsenal, whatever you want to call it. I mean, if you can beat them at their game, then that's sort of a feather in your cap, because now when you're in the real world and you're playing against players for real money and you're playing against players who are quality players, you can use your own tactics, whatever. But every once in a while, you're always going to come up against those types of players playing for real money, and you'll be that much more educated on how to what kind of ranges they're playing and what kind of hands they're playing, and I think that you can get something out of it. It's just, don't be looking for it. Don't think that it's going to ruin you. If anything, it should make you stronger for those moments when they do come up.
Yeah, it's not going to help you prepare to play against the best players in the world, but it will help you as far as that exercise and adjusting your game to the different opponents. So you're definitely right there.
All right, well, Lauren, we've had you on the show a few times, so obviously we're not going to give you some swag for this, but if someone else calls in and they have never won anything in the last year or so, we can give them something cool like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up Store at annieupstore.com. So we have a mailbag this week. It comes from Connor Boyle, and he says, "I cash around 35% of the time when I play tournaments. with basic poker knowledge and what I've picked up along the way. How do you play ace-king and ace-queen late in tournaments? I get burned with them so many times. Now, before we even address that, if you're cashing 35% of the time when you play tournaments, you don't even have to worry about how to play ace-king and ace-queen because you're cashing far more than most people cash by maybe 3.5 times or at least 2 times. I mean, that's crazy, 35% of the time. Don't you think?
It's insane unless you're playing sit-and-goes. And yeah. So if you're playing sit-and-goes, then you might not be doing that good. So, you know, you're close. So the thing is, yeah, if you're cashing 35% and you're playing a variety of different tournaments against, you know, lots of players and you know, in different locations, different buy-ins, like a lot of people are, it's way too high, actually. You know, the best players in the world are going to cash about 15% of the time.
Yeah.
And once you get up 20% and higher, then honestly, you're not cashing. I mean, you're cashing too often and you're not getting deep enough often enough. You know, so, you know, it's kind of hard to really say here because I don't know where he's playing. If it's just, you know, if it's a bar league and he's playing against the same people every week, then, yeah, that's realistic. And it's not, you know, it's not really unheard of. You know, I know a lot of people, the best players, just totally crush those leagues, you know, because there's a lot of people there that just don't care. They're not trying to improve. And, you know, and these players are doing what you have to do in, you know, kind of in like free online poker. They're adjusting to those crazy players who are just there to hang out and have a few beers and some appetizers. But yeah, so I mean, the cash rate is certainly way too high as far as multi-table tournaments go, but depending on his venues. And then it's a really vague question, to be honest with you.
I thought the same thing. I when I'm saying to myself, how do you play? Well, there are so many variables here that you have to consider. I mean, okay, so the one variable he's given us here is late in tournaments, but even so, it doesn't tell me anything. Does he have a big stack and he's got the ace-king? Is he under the gun with the ace-king? Is he calling an all-in of a short stack and there's no action behind him? I mean, there's really a lot to consider there. It's kind of, and it sounds to me when he says I get burned with them so many times, it sounds like to me that he's just, you know, he's probably shoving with them and, you know, when he's short stacked or something and getting called by a pair or a different hand that, you know, can call because of the, you know, the pot odds that they're getting on the money, and it's the fact that they can knock somebody out to move up in a place in money or something like that, where it's like a 60-40 kind of race and they know it's going to be that way. And so it is, it's very vague. I mean, I guess we could probably stretch this conversation into just, you know, what do you like, what kind of situation do you like to be in late in tournaments when you're looking down at those types of hands, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I like to, you know, when I'm doing my classes, I really stress more, you know, more of stack-based play than early, middle, and late tournament play.
Right.
You know, there's specifics to the bubble or, you know, a final table bubble or, you know, actually on the final table that, you know, are more specific. But there's, you know, it's really depending on your stack size. And hands like ace-king and ace-queen, when you get down into the 15 to 20 big blinds with a hand like ace queen, that's, you know, probably a hand you're going to go with depending on your position and the action in front of you. You know, a hand like ace king, even up to like 30 big blinds, you're probably going to try to get the money in and get chips. So, you know, it's a, you know, those hands, you know, the thing about it, it's like you said, it's usually like a 60-40 or just a true flip. You know, when you get action on ace queen, if you're shoving, you know, you're more likely going to get called by either a pair or ace king.
Yeah.
More often than you do even, you know, like an ace jack or ace 10. So, you know, and even when you hit those, you're still going to lose about 30% of the time. So, you know, those are hands that you get burned with them so many times, but you also remember when you get burned with them more than you remember when they win. You know, that pain of losing and busting is much more severe than, you know, the joy you get when the hands actually hold up. So, you know, I think it's so typical that you're going to be getting it in either with ace king or ace queen or some type of pair, and, you know, they're you're going to win about half the time, maybe 60% of the time. So that's a lot of times you're going to be losing.
Or you could get it in with ace queen suited against ace queen offsuit and still lose like I did last week at the charity event.
That'll be $20 for your bad beat.
And that was a bad beat. You know, I started to have that conversation with Faso last week, and I decided against to really pursuing it too much. But, I mean, I can totally understand why people want to tell bad beats when it knocks them out of a tournament. It's one thing to have a bad beat in the middle of the tournament, but you still have chips and you're playing and you still play for 5 or 6 hours. We don't want to hear that story. But I can understand people will get knocked out of a chance to go to the Venetian Deep Stack and be chip leader in the tournament and you get knocked out. You know what I mean? It's pretty brutal when things like that happen. So I can empathize, I guess, but I won't take it any further than that. All right, Connor. Well, despite the vagaries of your email to our mailbag, we're still going to send you something cool. We're going to give you the Grinder Bracelet from Pro Poker Gear, which sells much more than terrific bracelets for home games or leagues. They also sell hats and T-shirts and gifts in the AnyUp store at AnyUpStore.com. All right, our call to floor comes from Dave Rendall. He's in California, and he's got a real interesting situation. So why don't I let you read that, and then I'll tell you what Jody had to say.
All right. He says, I was playing a multi-table tournament in Las Vegas. The level was 500-1,000. He was in seat one on the button. Seat two is in the small blind, and seat three, who was short stacked, was in the big blind, and seat three busted out on this hand. And the blinds went to 1K, 2K. Before the next hand, we had a dealer change. Button was pushed to seat two, and seat three was open, obviously, because this guy busted out. Right. So seat four posted the 500, thinking it was he was just the small blind, and we were still at 500-1,000. The dealer told seat four he needed to post 1,000. So seat four looked up at the clock and saw that the blinds had gone up, and he posted 1,000. Seat five then put out the 2,000, believing he was a big blind. The hand played out, and before the next hand was dealt, the dealer announced that the blinds were up to 1K, 2K. Several players told her that they went up the previous hand, and she was a little late. The dealer then said that seat four had been the single and only blind last hand. Now the button becomes a dead button in the vacant seat three, and seat four was to post the small, and seat five the big blind. The whole table said this didn't appear to be fair, and the floor was called and ruled that seat four had been the big blind and was now the small blind for 1,000. Seat 5 was now the big blind and was told to put in 2,000. The floor said the 2,000 put in by seat 5 on the last hand was just a bet on that last hand, even though it was done before the hand had been dealt. What was the proper ruling?
Man, absolutely brutal. That is brutal. Okay, well, Jody says, TDA rule number 19 tells us that a new level doesn't begin until it is announced by a member of the tournament staff. In this situation, it seems the announcement wasn't made until after the dealer had already started the first hand she dealt at his table. The fact she knew there was one big blind in the first hand she dealt is a reflection of great communication between her and the outgoing dealer. The fact she didn't announce one big blind at the table shows inexperience on her part. She also could have asked seat 5 if they intended to raise dark, but we don't know if she saw the chip before the action began. Since we don't know if she was aware of the premature raise, we have to rely on the number one rule in every room. It is every player's responsibility to protect their own hand. This applies to protecting your chips as well. This is accomplished by an awareness of, among other things, how much the action is, which includes the amount and location of the blinds. Every player who was present when seat 3 went broke should have been aware there would be a single big blind in the next hand. Every player at the table, including seat 5, had the opportunity to ask what was going on before the next hand played out. In many floor decisions, I often ask myself what other rulings could be made here. In this instance, I believe there is only one reasonable alternative to the ruling that was made. The alternative would be to declare the last hand as a small blind of 1,000 in seat 4 and the big blind of 2,000 in seat 5. Technically, the ruling that was made was correct, but TDA rule number 1 does allow floor people to ignore the technical rules in pursuit of what is most fair and best for the game. So the question is, what would be most fair here? Is it fair for seat 4 to get away with paying the small blind only and then getting the button? What if this ruling meant a difference of seat 4 being all in for the small blind or having the button and getting an entire orbit of hands, which could result in his winning the tournament instead of busting out? If a table broke at this point and the new player to seat 3 didn't get the button they were entitled to have because it was in seat 4, would that be fair? In my opinion, the most fair ruling here is to tell seat 5 to pay closer attention and keep the button in blinds where they are supposed to be. As the tournament director, I would have a chat with the dealer about paying closer attention and protecting the game better, but the ruling here was the most fair ruling and absolutely correct. And I have to agree, and I tell you what, these tournament directors are put in some difficult situations, and they have to think quickly on their feet, even though they do have these rules that they can refer to or whatever. you know, I mean, it's not like they can bring the book over with them and sit there and scramble through it while the clock is ticking on a tournament. You know what I mean? They have to have that answer ready. And it does sound like that this was the most fair decision, and it's just too bad that C5 didn't really understand that they weren't in the big blind, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. There's no way that you could then, you know, change it, and, you know, from that point forward. So I think it's 100% the right ruling.
All right, well, Dave, thanks for sending in that situation for Call the Floor. We're going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft, and you don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes Store. All right, well, Scott, obviously this week had a couple of meetups, and I had one last week, but we have a couple of more left on the schedule here, as we mentioned during the show a couple minutes ago. Scott and I will be in Vegas the week of June 25th to the 29th, and on June 27th, we'll be crashing Karina Jett's weekly 6-12 mixed game starting at 6 p.m. at the MGM Grand. I'm not exactly sure if we'll be actually playing the 6-12 game or if we'll be bringing the limits down a little bit to help, you know, bankrolls of our fans, because our fans generally don't play 6-12 type games. But if not, then we'll just get a table of something else going that everybody else wants to play. Also, in New Mexico, Scott's going to be there on June 30th, and we got a couple people saying that they're interested already, so it looks like that might happen. They'll try to get a cash game going at one of the casinos, and then also at the Isle Blackhawk in Colorado, July 1st or 2nd, Scott again will be going through town there. So email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and let us know if you're interested in any of these dates, and we'll see what we can do to get them going. Now, our next cruise is coming up, and you're not going to be there. We're so sad.
I know.
It's going to be August 27th out of Port Canaveral. We'll have giveaways planned at Suncoast in Las Vegas, Palm Beach Kennel Club, Seminole Hard Rock Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, and Ebro Greyhound Park. You can get all the details of those things at antiupmagazine.com/cruise. And then November 10th out of Baltimore, right near you, we're going to have another cruise. We're going to have a giveaway, too, at Dover Downs. So we're doing pretty well there. We got a lot of people for the next cruise, and the Baltimore one is starting to fill up pretty quick, too, so pretty excited.
And I will be on that one.
Yes, so we're looking forward to that.
Family in tow, and I already have a couple of friends and guys that have been to some of my classes that will be there, so you guys better bring your game, because I know they're solid, and we'll be doing some courses on the cruise as always, but I can't wait. That's going to be an awesome one, and don't have to fly. I get to drive there, and whole family's coming, even the in-laws.
Awesome. Okay, so this is usually the moment of the show when I tell Scott to tell me what's going on around the world with our Antiup news desk, but I'll get it kicked off here. Chiab Saicho, beginning an inevitable streak of mispronounced names this summer on the Antiup PokerCast, won the opening World Series event, taking down the $500 Casino Employees Championship for $70,000.
Nice.
There's some loose interpretations of what you need to be a casino employee, I think, too. So I wonder if there's some way I can, hey, you know, I publish a magazine, and our magazine's in a casino, so we're kind of working for a casino. Any chance I can get in, you know, who knows?
I know, I work at the casino.
That's right, you work at the casino, absolutely.
Like all of them.
That's right, you do your job at every casino. Shouldn't you be allowed to be in the casino employee tournament?
I even do trainings in a casino, or do those at Borgata. Oh, man.
You should be in this event. Why aren't you out there? That's a pretty good payday for $500.
Yeah, heck yeah. That's great. Yeah, I saw Ty Stewart been there, too.
Yeah, he got pretty deep.
Yeah. And Tom Marchese, the Big Cheese, won the 100K WPT Super High Roller, good for just a little $1.3 million.
Oh, that's it.
Had the bankroll before the World Series, so I'm sure he will be playing absolutely everything. I know he's a phenomenal player. He's a high stakes cash game player.
Yeah.
Made tons of money playing online. And then Marvin Guido Rittenmeyer captured the 25K WPT World Championship at the Bellagio for $1.2 million there. So
pretty interesting stuff too, that you enter the 25K World Championship and you win 1.2, but you enter the high roller and you win 1.3.
Yeah.
You know, it's like which one's been paid the right amount. But
I kinda like the 25K for 1.2 rather than just getting 10 times your money. But I would, that'd be nice to just put up $100K. I was thinking about selling for the, you know, they've got the one drop, the $1 million buy-in.
Yeah.
For one drop. And I was thinking about just selling my action at 1.2 to 1 and sell 100%.
You're already making $2,000. That's 200 grand.
Pocket the 200 grand. I mean, I might even do it at 1.1. 1.05, pocket the 50 grand and use that for those 5-10 games. But yeah, I think, you know, this both of those guys are phenomenal. Rettenmeier, looked him up, and he's had almost $3 million in earnings. So he had a couple of million in earnings already, and had some. I think he won a couple hundred grand in April. So he's on a heater coming into the summer as well.
Yeah, and he's no slouch, obviously, to beat the players that he did. I mean, that World Championship is always basically, it's like the Masters in golf. You know, you have to really win a WPT event to be in, and then you can buy indirect or whatever. But for the most part, you're only seeing champions on that thing. So to win, that's pretty.
The final table, where there's some beasts there. I know Michael Mizrachi was there, and Nick Schulman was there, Steve O'Dwyer, who's had a lot of deep runs there. Like you know, it wasn't an easy final table, and like you said, the field in general is just absurd.
Man. All right, and finally, six leaders from South Korea's largest Buddhist order resigned after a secret video showed the monks playing high-stakes poker, drinking, and smoking. The stakes for 13 hours of gambling were more than $825,000 U.S. dollars. That was according to a senior monk who told Reuters. Apparently, you know, unorganized gambling is illegal in South Korea, and then when you have your monks doing it, it's probably frowned upon, but... good God. First of all, what are these guys doing with that kind of cash?
You know, I remember when I saw that, I think it was from donations. It was like people they gave to their order or whatever. You know,
God.
It was actually their, you know, I don't know, like from their fundraising efforts or whatever they have there.
Oh, my God. That is absolutely insane. And of course, we all know that playing poker isn't gambling. So what were they getting guff over anyway? I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, maybe because they were smoking.
Oh, man, that is crazy. All right, so, you know, usually this part of the show, we do the O'Malley's Move. We're going to give you an extra week to think about it. Then when Scott comes back, we'll give our thoughts. We don't want Lee doing it because Lee will just spoil the fun of actually doing the correct move. So we're going to give that another week to marinate in your mind. And now we're going to talk to Lee a little bit about our main topic today. You know, Lee, you know, when we have you on the show, we always like to pick your brain because we feel like... you know, you were one of us in the beginning, and then you said, you know what, I have a bigger brain than most people, so I'm going to take this to the next level and really study and really become a good player in poker. And so whenever we have someone like you on the show, we always want to try to extract some knowledge from you. And, of course, you know, we know that you have the Acumen Poker that you founded for your one-on-one stuff, and now you've got this new Inside the Minds that you and some other really good players are getting together and getting some really good feedback and good reaction to, especially at the Borgata. And then, you know, of course, everybody had their chance to experience this on our November cruise that we just talked about a few minutes ago. So we're always excited to have you on the show. And sometimes we tend to forget that, you know, when Scott and I are giving our advice, it's just basically, you know, a different way to look at a hand. It's not necessarily... the more advanced the way to look at a hand. And a lot of times our listeners tend to get frustrated with that because they're progressing beyond us, sort of like you, the way you've obviously progressed beyond what we were teaching you in the beginning or talking to you about on the shows when you first started listening to us. So we had a letter come to us recently from Sean Levine, and it said, I've been an avid listener of your podcast since the beginning, and I know most of your listeners probably are not higher-level players. But as the games have gotten tougher over the past 5 years or so, I'd love to hear an episode with some more advanced hold'em hands for people who play 2-5 and above, where it's not just ABC poker. For example, how to choose spots to 3-bet with a wider range as a squeeze or isolation play. Also, how to proceed in 3-bet pots if you've been called and now you have hit or not hit the flop with a weaker holding, and you're in a much more bloated pot. In my area, we have underground games 6 days a week, and there are the same 40 to 50 people that rotate through the games. So if you want to be a consistent winner, you can't just play ABC poker because everyone knows how everyone else plays. So, I mean, it's just sort of like a like a jam session here, for guys to get together before the Hall of Fame inductions. And, you know, I don't think that we're really have any kind of structure to what we want to talk about here, but I know that there are things that you probably consider when you're in hands and when you're playing that a lot of us just don't think of or comprehend. So I'm wondering if you can help Sean here, and then we can take it from there.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, first of all, you can look at this as a huge advantage playing against the same 40 to 50 people that rotate through the games, you know, if they're depending on their skill level, obviously. You know, if you're one of the better players, then this is an extremely exploitable game and, you know, situation to be in. You know, playing the circuit, I play in tournaments with a lot of the same players, and you're able to use that knowledge and, you know, and to... You know, when you know somebody's general ranges, the game just becomes that much easier. So, you know, I think first of all, it's you know, every game is beatable, and you just have to figure out how to beat it. So, obviously, in a game like this, now I wouldn't say you can't just play ABC, because oftentimes in games like this, you know, it depends on your definition of ABC.
Yeah.
You know, if players are ABC and you know the and, you know, like say they, you know, always limp their smaller pairs and suited connectors. And, you know, playing straight forward, they're going to try to play small pots with those hands and they're going to raise their big hands. You know, then yeah, that's 2 ABC as far as, you know, giving away information about their hands. But, you know, in beating these games, first of all, if there's a lot of times you'll see a lot of multi-way pots. So whether they're raised or limped, there's lots of multi-way pots. So, you know, I would consider limping a pretty wide range, and there are things you can do to change your game. You know, if you know how they're all playing, then you can do things such as, you know, like limp in early position, whether you've got big hands or weak hands, and then, you know, play accordingly based on what happens. Like, you know, I've played in games where you'd often get 6 people to the flop no matter what the raise is. You know, I was playing in a 5-10 game one time, and the raise would be to 60 or 70, and you'd literally get 6 or 7 people to the flop.
Man.
So, you know, a hand like 2 aces is almost worthless if you come in raising for 50 or 60, and then you're going to get 5 or 6, 7 players. You just can't do that. So, you know, in those games, you could, you know, change it up and maybe limp and raise those hands, where I don't really advocate doing a lot of limping and then raising. But in a game like that, where the pot is going to be so huge, and you'd limp with your 2 aces, and then 4 people are in for $60. Now you can raise and take down the pot right there, you know, and that's yeah. worth winning. You're not looking to play those hands post flop so much as just figuring out the best way to get value. I think another key thing is to, you know, as he mentions, he's wanted to choose spots to 3-bet with a wider range. The key to that is just playing in position. And picking spots to occasionally 3-bet with a suited connector, small pairs, look for players that maybe, you know, your weaker players that are either limping in, or maybe they raise but you've got position on them and you can raise to isolate them. Because I'm guessing most of the time, if somebody raises, he's probably, you know, most players aren't going to 3-bet unless they've got a really big hand. And now they've defined their hand, which sometimes people think is a good thing. And, you know, in your raising in those cases, because you want to raise for value, you want to try to get against 1 or 2 opponents rather than have the whole field in there. So you do want to be 3-betting with those hands, but you also can 3-bet with your suited connectors. And then when they just call you, you know they're most likely calling with the same types of hands that you have. So, you know, if you 3-bet with the 5-6 of spades and the flop comes down ace, king, deuce, that's a really good flop for you based on how they've played the hand, you know. And you just need to know, is this a player that's going to raise and call out of position with aces, or, you know, or an ace in their hand, or are they, you know, are they going to have the pairs and suited connectors like most people do? So those are a couple of things there. You know, I think one key is not playing real fancy, you know, just the fancy play syndrome will get you stuck, and I see a lot of people trying to slow play their big hands, and then when they're making big bets, it's actually when they have nothing, and it's just completely backwards. You know, it's hard to flop a huge hand, so when you do, you've got to play them pretty straightforward and just bet them and get the money in there. and, you know, and then adjust to your players based on, you know, how what you know about their ranges as to whether or not you should actually be playing for stacks when you have kind of a mediocre holding.
So when we're talking about these 40 or 50 same people coming through, you're thinking too then that this is like could evolve into level 4 or level 5 thinking, right? Because you've played with them so often, and it says that even his last sentence of the letter was, you can't just play ABC poker because everyone knows how everyone else plays. So if you already know how this person plays, now you have to think to yourself, okay, I know how this person plays, this person knows how I play, so I have to play the opposite of the way I would play in this situation, but is he going to know that I'm playing the opposite in this? You know what I mean? So there's this extra level that could evolve from it. Is there sort of a buy-in level that you think this happens and where it doesn't happen and you shouldn't really concern yourself with that?
Well, you know, again, it'll depend on the actual caliber of the players there, but I think, you know, for the most part, you're not going to see a lot of, you know, level 4-5 thinking at a 2-5 game, and really not a whole lot at 5-10 unless you've got a lot of regulars. And, you know, you go to the Borgata on a weekday and play, with no tournament series going on, and play the 5-10 game, yeah, you're probably going to have several good players because they're probably mostly professionals. So, you know, so you'll have that going on. But at the same time, you know, sometimes you get those players who are, you know, leveling, you know, themselves and against these other players, and you might be able to exploit those guys a little better because you'll get, you know, they'll have you caught in the middle and not realize what's going on because they're so focused on the regular. So in this case, he's got a lot of regulars. I don't think he has to play completely opposite, but I think it's occasionally picking spots where he's going to make those three bets in position where he's representing a big hand. He still needs to be doing that with a wide range of hands, with his big hands, but he needs to do it with some of those mediocre holdings as well, because most of the time it's just going to result in somebody calling you that's out of position against you. They're going to miss the flop and they're going to check and fold. And if they don't, then you know that they've got something. So, you know, chalk it up. It didn't work that time. Move on to the next one. But, you know, you don't want to be trying to squeeze out of position. You know, some of these things, you know, squeezing and a lot of these isolation plays, you know, people use them too much in cash games sometimes where they're just not really necessary and they're more of a tournament play. Isolating for sure. You know, you want to isolate some of those weaker players. You don't want to fall into the trap where you've got several regulars and they're friends of yours, and you all know that a couple of guys are pretty weak. So, you know, I've seen this a lot where then several of you get in the pots against them, and then you kind of know when you need to get out because the other guy seems to have it. You know, I wouldn't do that. You know, I'd focus on my stack, my money, and what's advantageous for me. And that means exploiting some of these people that you know, exploiting your friends. You know, we're playing poker here. So it's not about friendship. You know, you need to be able to know that If I three bet Bob's under the gun raise, you know, he's going to think I absolutely have to have aces or kings, you know, and where I'm always calling with everything else. And then at the same time, occasionally call with those big hands. Go ahead and allow yourself to get in a multi-way pot with aces or ace king, but then play them for two pair or better. You know, just because you get two aces doesn't mean you've got to try to win a big pot. Most right. of the time you're going to win a small one or lose a big one anyway. So, you know, playing hands like that, you know, playing the same hands a little bit differently, but at the same time trying to be consistent. And, you know, maybe you've got set a timer or something where, you know, it's a reminder to kind of change gears and you go from kind of a more limping strategy and calling strategy to where you're pretty much only raising and re-raising. And that way you're limping your big hands, you're limping your small hands. And then you switch, you know, that timer goes off and now you're only raising or re-raising when you come in. So if you're changing that up and you have the discipline to, you know, get away from those big hands unless you flop a monster, you know, and realize that your two black aces is not good in a six-way pot on a 7, 8, 9 of hearts board, you know, and you just say, oh man, I should have raised because I had two aces. Like, it doesn't matter. Like,
yeah.
You're going to see tons and tons of hands against these same players, and those spots will come up, and you just have to be patient to, you know, it's so key in cash games to have two pair or better. You should be playing deep, you know, so you shouldn't be playing a lot of 100 big blind pots.
Right. So a lot of this, too, has to deal with perception, especially three betting. And it, to me, it seems it gets back to, you know, when people say, you know, betting gives you two chances to win here. One, they may fold and you'll take it down. Or two, you may have the best hand or whatever. You know how they say that. Same with sort of three betting. The perception of a three bet, if you mix up the hands that you do it with, you know, people will perceive you as having a big hand. So if a big card comes, you can represent it. But at the same time, you don't necessarily have to have that big hand. You have the small hand. When you hit that, they'll never put you on that hand. So it's all perception. And also that you have to have opponents who are able to perceive what you're doing and keep track of what you're doing, that kind of thing. If you don't want to do, like we talked with Lauren earlier about ABC poker against players who don't know what they're doing. So we're talking about a higher level of playing here where people will be able to put it together that what a three bet means or what your style means, right? It's all about perception.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if you're playing against, you know, the thing is with this group, you know, we don't know how many players are actually pretty high level players and, you know, or rather they're just regulars. You know, you see a lot of times I hear people say like, oh yeah, he's a pretty solid regular and he limped here in this spot, like, and he's doing things that aren't indicative of a solid player. So, you know, it really depends on, you know, is he assessing the level of play? And I'm not saying he's not, but if they are pretty solid, then, you know, you have to be changing these things up. I mean, he's kind of pegged it himself that he, you know, he doesn't think he can just play his hands really straightforward, but that doesn't mean to get it fall into a trappy kind of a game. It means that you need to just open up and play certain hands, but still try, you know, you don't need to be three betting with the Jack Deuce off, you know, but maybe with the Jack 8 suited, you know, you might pick a spot to three bet when you're in position. You know, and another key thing is, you know, it's called merging your range. And a lot of times this will apply on the, you know, on the river where, you know, when you make a bet, it's kind of a half value bet, half bluff. Like you're not exactly sure what they hold, but you know, it's a spot where, you know, say you've got two kings on a queen, queen, 3-3-4 board. And when you bet there, you'll get calls from a lot of mid pairs and you'll get ace high calling you, thinking you're just bluffing, you know, maybe you've missed a draw. And so you're betting for value, or even say you have like two jacks or two tens there. You know, where a lot of people would think, oh, well, you don't have the queen. I know you don't have a queen. I know you don't have a three. So you've got to be bluffing. And then they call you with the weaker hands.
Yeah.
And so you need to make sure, a lot of people lose value on those hands. And that's kind of a real simple example, but you know, sometimes it's even where you've got the smaller pair and you know that somebody may call you with just an ace high, and you know, or you think maybe they've got like a small ace, maybe they hit their kicker, and you know, so you need to be able to make sure you're getting value out of those hands by merging your range there on the river.
One of the weaknesses that I have, and I'm fully aware of it, is the three bet. And I think the reason being is because, one, I don't really stray too far from a 1-3 game or a 2-5 game. I very rarely have ever played outside of that. And ABC poker works perfectly well for me to almost always walk away with some sort of profit from these games. And since I don't do it for a living, and I don't play all the time, I just don't have either enough experience to say, okay, I need to be three betting more, or the need to, because I'm not playing for my bread and butter. I'm just playing for entertainment, or because I'm on a cruise and it's my poker room and I should be playing there, or we're on a trip and we should be playing in that room, or whatever the reason may be. But really, the three bet for me is such a weak portion of my game these days, because I just don't have a lot of reasons to use it. And so for a lot of our listeners, I'm sure that this could be the case, because, you know, most people who listen to our show are just listening to it to be entertained with one of Scott's inane, you know, ramblings or something. And so, you know, they want to hear the strategy and they want to hear the different ways to play hands and things like that. But really, when it comes right down to it, I very rarely 3-bet unless I have a huge hand. And so I wonder if there is some sort of kernel of knowledge that you can pass on to someone who doesn't sit down regularly but wants to play more aggressively. And that's the other thing, too, is once you've decided, okay, this seems like a really good spot to 3-bet because of whatever some of the factors that you've laid out here. Okay, I'm going to 3-bet here, and then I do get the call. All right, now what do I do? What do I do at that point? Are you saying that, is there any kind of, like, let's say we decide to take that leap with a jack-eight because we were in position and we felt like we had a guy under the gun raising and a guy in the middle just calling, and we know that their ranges, from what we've experienced, are generally, you know, ace-king, and then the guy calling is probably calling with a suited ace. So we 3-bet with jack-eight, hoping to get heads-up with one of them or something, and then we do get heads-up, but then the flop comes rags. So are we supposed to now represent a big hand because that's what we did? That's the perception I was talking about earlier, and then follow through with the plan? Or what if they bet into you at that point? There are all these scenarios that, you know, just make the 3-bet so precarious.
Yeah, I think, and one key thing is that people should not go crazy 3-betting in cash games. You know, it's critical for tournaments to find these spots. But cash games, the main thing is you mentioned under the gun. First of all, I would, unless you really know the players well and they've got a really wide range under the gun, you know, I want to pick my 3-bet spots on somebody that's in middle to late position, and I want to be in position on them as well. And, you know, maybe I 3-bet and somebody, maybe I'm in the cutoff and now the button calls, or he 4-bets me, you know, now, okay, well, let's assess it here. Did I actually have a hand?
Right.
Or, you know, this is going to come into kind of the leveling thing. And, you know, keep in mind, once you've shown down that you 3-bet with the 5-7 of diamonds, you know, and that gets shown down, then that's all going to change. So but I think the key is not only going after, you know, middle and late position limpers or raisers, but 3-betting with, specifically with your big hands, occasionally with suited connectors, and occasionally with small pairs. You know, most of the time in a cash game, I'm going to want to call with those suited connectors and small pairs because I'm okay with a multi-way pot, but I want to do that against players that I think have a big hand or I'm in a multi-way pot. So, you know, if the cutoff raises and I've got a suited connector on the button, if I'm going to play it, I'm more than likely going to raise it there. I'm going to 3-bet that spot because he's got a really wide range. I don't expect him to have a hand where if I hit, I can take it down, but I can win a pot that's worthwhile if I 3-bet and then one of the blinds calls or he calls, you know, or both of them call, and then just knowing that my continuation bet is going to take it down most of the time. So, yeah, absolutely. If you take that initiative and 3-bet and then get heads up in position against one or two people, then when that flop comes down, you just need to trust yourself and trust the fact that continuation bets work. And, you know, if you have to adjust. When you have a player that seems to check raise a lot, then, you know, you maybe are going to bet only when you have nothing. And, you know, you may occasionally go ahead and check it back when you actually have a hand if you've got a real aggressive player who's then going to, you know, try to take it away from you. But most of the time, if I smash it, I'm just going to go ahead and bet because, you know, people do like to – you get those certain players that do like to check raise a lot because they know you're going to miss the flop most of the time. But, you know, you don't want to get into the habit of playing these real big pots with nothing in a cash game. It's just not – the hands will come around and, you know, with enough frequency. And you got to remember, when you're sitting there playing a cash game, I don't care if you're there for a couple hours or all night long, a lot of times you just need to win one nice pot.
Yeah.
And it's worth it. You know, if you're playing 2-5 and you sit down for 5 hours and just play one pot for stacks, you're making $100 an hour.
Yeah.
So don't get caught up in wanting to play this, you know, this cat and mouse game and this leveling game. It makes it way too hard. So, you know, I really, you know, these are things you can do in cash games to change up and help make yourself not so predictable. But, you know, they're really... And for me and with my game, you know, I've just found cash games even up to 5-10 and really even higher. I've played in some pretty big ones. I had a guy stake me for a 5,100 game one time at the Borgata years ago, and it was pretty insane to be, you know, raising to $300-$400.
Yeah.
But you know, he was putting me in it. He was playing the game, and I just crushed those guys. You know, they just had money. They weren't any better. Sometimes you get in those games, and you know, they just weren't. You know, this was several years ago too, before lots of people got really good. But you know, I think it's important to keep that mindset that you don't need to be involved and make a lot of plays. You don't get your value in cash games by bluffing and making a lot of moves. You get your value by betting your hands properly and trying to get the maximum out of your winning hands rather than try to steal a bunch of pots here and there.
Hey, can you, three or four times now you've mentioned leveling. For those who don't understand what that means, can you let them know?
Yeah, basically leveling, you know, you kind of, it goes from, you know, it kind of comes from different levels of players. And then, you know, when you say leveling, you know, maybe you're leveling yourself. A lot of times I've had that happen where, you know, like say I've got a player that's relatively inexperienced, but I basically talk myself into the fact that he has to be bluffing because he would never bet this hand this way. Actually, sometimes I was talking to somebody recently about merging. And I think a lot of bad players unintentionally merged their ranges. And I had a hand where I had called on the button from an early position raiser. I had like Jack 8 suited. And the board came 8 high. He bet. And I called. And I just I thought he probably had a big hand. And I was going to dump it on the turn. But the turn put a possible straight there. And he bet again, but bet real small. And there were also two hearts on the flop. And so I decided to call again because now it was a pretty big pot and the bet was so small. And I figured my jack or eight was good. And also I'd be able to assess on the river, you know, if he actually had a huge hand. And then by the river, there was a four card straight on the board and the hearts missed. And the guy moved all in. And at this point, I was like, well, he can't have aces or kings now. Like, yeah. There's no way he can have aces or kings because I can only call with, I think I needed a four or a nine in my hand to make the straight, whatever it was. And I took a long time. Like, he just has to be bluffing. And so I called, and he showed me the two kings. And his rationale, he said, well, I knew that if I was beat, he was going to snap call, and I didn't want to be forced to make the call. If I checked, then he moved in. And so he ends up getting called by a weaker hand. And he actually thought he was probably beat, and I could only call if he was beat, and he still put all his chips in.
Man.
And I had the guy covered. So you have to be really careful with that. And, you know, that's, you know, there's times where, and this will come into play for our guy here, Sean, that, you know, when you're, when you do know a lot about the players, you may be thinking and playing on a different level than they are at that particular moment, and you need to make sure this, you know, and this kind of comes into play, like, say you've shown a bluff to somebody, and then later somebody is making a big bet on you, and you're like, well, I bet you he's bluffing me, and he doesn't realize maybe you've got two pair on, like, a straight or flush board, and they think you don't have anything because you showed that one bluff, and you might not actually know if they were paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have to be really careful with what, who knows what information. So, you know, if you, you're playing with these regulars all the time, you gotta figure it out. It's your job as a player to know, are they capable of remembering that hand from 3 months ago that you think you're, you know, representing now? You know, and that's why it gets kind of tough, and you just gotta make sure you're on the right level there.
Okay, so if you really liked what Lee had to say, don't forget you can always come on our cruise in November, and you can get all the information at antiupmagazine.com/cruise, where he'll give a free course. But it'll also have some one-on-one training that you can invest in, and of course we have the Inside the Minds, which we'll talk about a little bit after the hand of the week. I think we'll talk about some stuff that's coming up for you there, and of course Acumen Poker. So let's move on to our hand of the week.
All right.
This comes from Ryan Gibbs, and again Ace Queen rigs her ugly head, rears her ugly head. What did I say? Rigs.
Whatever.
Rears her ugly head. I'll set it up for you. He calls it a situation. I think it's a true bona fide hand of the week. It comes in a bar league finals tournament. So again, a lot of the themes coming through the show today: ace queen and bar leagues and free leagues and things like that. About 170 people were in this event. Final table gets cash. Top two get an entry into a World Series event, $1,000, plus travel money. So, I mean, you're actually playing for something here, whether it's, you know, free leagues or not. You got some pretty decent stuff to be playing for. So he said there's a mix of good players and bad. And he had about 16,000 in chips, which he says is 40 big blinds. And there were still 80 players left at this point. The blinds were 200 and 400, though it was just announced that blinds were going up to 300, 600 on the next hand. Our hero here is in seat 1, and a player he knows pretty well joined just a few hands ago is in seat 10. Calls him a solid player, capable of just about anything, but he says he's a typical tight aggressive, doesn't bluff too much. Under the gun folds, seat 10, this new player, raises to 1,000, has about 16,000 behind, and we look down, of course, at ace-queen suited in hearts. There's a crazy player to my left on the button, and he says he's loose-aggressive, which I guess means crazy, and has him covered, too. But the blind players in the blind seem to be pretty tight. He wants to know what you would do in this situation.
All right, so we've got this guy. We've got about the same amount of chips. We got 40 big blinds with ace queen. Now, are we at a full table here?
I would believe so, since there's 80 players left in the tournament.
So I'm guessing he says under the gun folds and seat 10 raise. I guess he's under the gun plus one, and he's raised to 1,000. Now, first of all, like it's a standard raise for this amount, for this level, and what I really want to do is. Is, you know, if I know that he's pretty solid, then I would actually lean towards just folding an ace queen since he's raising from early position. Or, you know, I might raise it, say, you know, since he is solid, I've got a premium hand, although, you know, I'm telling you, ace queen, ace jack, I've said it before. I don't know if I've said it on here, but I really think that if you had to make a rule for yourself as to, you know, either you can't ever play those two hands, or you got to figure out how to play them profitably. You'd be better off making the rule to just never play them.
Yeah.
You know, I think they get people a lot in trouble. In trouble way too often. Because you know, you got to think about if he's raising from early position, he should have an ace or a suited connector. So if he has an ace, it's less likely a lower ace. And if he is a solid player, so he shouldn't be raising an ace jack or ace ten in early position. So. You know, I think three betting is fine here. Since we're not that deep, I would be making, and I've got position on this player, I would err towards a smaller size. I mean, and it doesn't really matter where I'm raising from here, but as long as I'm in position, then I'm going to make it, you know, somewhere around 2.25 to 2.5 times. So if I was going to raise, I'd make it about, you know, 2250 to 2500, but folding is fine too since he's a solid player in early position. And as far as the crazy player to the left, you know, that player's several players away. I'm not going to just make my play based on him. You just can't. You right. Can't think. You know, this is an early position raise. You don't have any information of whether or not he's going to play this hand. But
right, and we know that player is on the button, so we're obviously not on the button. So there is a good possibility we won't have position on the entire field that decides to go to the flop, but we do have on this initial raiser, and we have to hope. So originally you said that you could see yourself folding because it's such a difficult hand, especially against someone in early position raising who's pretty solid. But if you're going to play it, you don't see yourself calling, right? You see yourself raising about
I don't like calling because now you've got a hand that's not going to play well in a multi-way pot, and if you call here, there's a good chance that some others are going to come along, especially the big blind, because it's only going to be 600 more.
Right.
So you're probably going to be in at least a three-way pot, and you've got this player on the button that may call once they've got a chance to call with any two on the button. And you know, depending on their stacks, they're probably getting a pretty good price to come in. So I don't like calling. Ace queen does not play well multi-way. You want to be heads up or, you know, against a couple of opponents. And I'd rather be the aggressor with it as well. And by doing a smaller three bet, you know, you're going to find out if this player has a really big hand or not. And, you know, if they come back over the top, it's an easy fold. And, you know, but if you just flat here, you're just going to have no idea where you are in this hand, and you might get in a big multi-way pot.
Okay, well, he says his thoughts are, why only 1,000? To me, I thought 1,000 was fine, because that's more than two, and it's almost three times. It's right around where you want to be raising. So that didn't put up a flag to me, but to him, it was a flag. He said, based on what I knew about the player in C10, his bet seemed too small. I think if he had any pair bigger than sevens, he would raise more to protect his hand. Ace-king, ace-jack, ace-10, king-queen, with a question mark. He says, possible. Small pair, possible, but not as likely. I think he would just call with a small pair in early position. I actually thought about just folding, but then thought about re-raising, but would have to go to at least 3,000 with an aggressive player to my left on the button. And after all, it is just ace-queen, right? I decided just to call and see what the player to my left would do and what the flop would bring. My plan was to flop two pair or better or get out unless the board was not too coordinated and I hit the queen or a flush draw. What do you think about that?
Yeah, first of all, if this guy is a solid player, you shouldn't be confused about the 1K. And this is contradictory that if he's a solid player and that he thinks if he had, you know, sevens or higher, he would raise, and the Broadway cards he'd raise. But since he raised small, that he thinks it's a small pair, not as like, you know, I think if this player is varying their bet sizes or raise sizes based on what they have, then they're not a solid player.
Yeah, exactly.
So first of all, you're absolutely right. The 1K is fine. And, you know, the thing is, if this guy is, if he has a betting pattern tell like that, then you should be able to know that by now if he knows this player. So if he sometimes raises to 1,000, sometimes 1,500, 2,000, whatever, you know, if he's varying that, then you should be able to exploit that, and you should know if it's a really big hand or a small hand. But I think it's important here for Ryan to incorporate into his own game that he should be raising a consistent amount based on the level, not based on his hand strength. So and raising 2.5 times is fine, you know, and raising more is fine also. You have to, depends on your experience and, you know, in what position you're going to be in. I like to raise a little more if I'm going to be out of position. Say I'm re-raising out of the blinds. But if I'm, you know, going to have position on somebody, I'd err towards the smaller side. So, you know, the re-raise amount here shouldn't really matter, because if they've got, you know, they're probably sitting around average with the 40 big blinds. So just making it about 2,500 would be fine. It's likely going to get other players out. You know, you can't. Calling here is just terrible because of being in a multi-way pot with ace queen, and so at the same time of, you know, you're not, if you just flat here and want to just go with two pair or better only, you're kind of devaluing the dreaded scary ace queen. You know, yeah. I mean, it's a hand you have to be careful with, but you have to play it for its value too. It is a strong hand. It is a premium holding. It just this is exactly why it gets people in trouble. And I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen here, but, you know, when you just call, if you're like, I don't really want to raise because it's just ace queen, you know, what are you doing with two aces there? Or what are you doing with two jacks there? You know, if you're just calling with ace queen, but you're going to raise with ace king or aces, then you've got a major betting pattern tell here.
Yeah.
So I really, playing a tournament, you've got to look for spots to three bet, especially with your big hands. And occasionally with your smaller ones, or, you know, in the spot, if a solid player raised under the gun, you could call them in position with your smaller pairs or suited connectors. I mean, you know, I know that comes up a lot, but it really is those are the things you got to look for. So, I would definitely raise, and I'm not worried about that other player. I don't want to just call and then see what this crazy guy does. Sounds like he's a little nervous about playing against this other player, and so. Just calling and then letting this player come in and having position on him, it's just he's setting himself up for failure. So I would, because if I'm a little nervous about playing against that player, that's even more of a reason to re-raise it or just fold.
Plus the call is now counterintuitive, because you, by calling, are giving this loose guy who's loose, not only does he have position on you, but now you're giving him decent odds to just make this call and float on you the whole way. So obviously the raise here is probably the either raise or fold, because if you're just calling now, the whole reason you just called is because you were afraid this guy would come in, but because you called, you made him come in.
Yeah.
So it's really just counterintuitive. Well, exactly as he feared, he called, the button called too, and he called pretty quickly. The blinds got out of the way, so we're three-handed to the flop, which is queen of spades, six of spades, three of diamonds. Right away, the seat 10 under the gun, early position raiser bets 3,000 fairly quickly. What do we think?
That's pretty standard. It's kind of big. You know, it's almost a pot-sized bet, right? We only had three of us.
Yeah, in the blind, so yeah, it's a little less than the pot size.
Yeah, so it's not out of line at all. You know, anywhere from half to the full pot, and you know, I think he's representing really his full range here, because you know, if he does have a betting pattern tell, it would be about the same, I think. You know, and if he had two aces there, then people are likely to bet that much because they're now scared of the flush draw, which is, you know, two people in, I'm not going to be that worried about it. But I just, the key is to be standard. So regardless of that, you know, and I know this isn't our hero's action, but I'm going to be betting around 2/3 of the pot. But a bet of 3K is fine and doesn't really tell me anything further about his hand.
All right, well, he said this screamed continuation bet to him, and maybe he thought it was too quick of an assumption. So then he started going over some of the hands. Set? No, he would have checked. Maybe he would bet here to get a flush draw out, but I didn't put him on a raise preflop with 6-6 or 3-3. I think he would have just called here in early position with those hands. So then he says, flush draw? Maybe. He's a good player and might bet here to get value out of his draw or take the pot now. Ace-ace or king-king? Always possible, but unlikely. I figured he would have raised more preflop to protect his hand, especially with king-king to get hands like mine out. What I ended up deciding was that he was most likely making continuation bet. Maybe he had a weaker queen or was on a flush draw. So
okay. That's a lot of assuming there.
Yeah.
If he has a set, I think he would have bet. You know, if he knows, I mean, if this is how this player plays, then this is a tremendous amount of information that he has, because it sounds like this player isn't as solid as Ryan thinks. However, it sounds like Ryan's got the player pegged pretty well as far as what he would do with certain hands. But I think, you know, if he's going to check a set there, that's pretty bad. But he, like I said, against two players, he should be betting here about 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So I think people with sets, even if they do have betting pattern tells, I think a set is very likely to bet almost the pot here with the two spades out there. And obviously with the six and the three there, that, you know, that's going to fall into the range of the button's calling range where he might have suited connectors. So I think a set's going to bet. I think pretty much anything would be betting. And then, you know, if he knows he's not raising preflop with sixes or threes, that he would have just called in early position, then, yeah, absolutely, he can rule those out. And then I think it's just a little bit too limiting to put him on either a set, a flush draw, or aces or kings, because I think if the guy has two tens, he should be betting jacks, you know, really his full range.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't... unless you know that he typically raises less or raises more with big hands, then I wouldn't read anything into that 1K raise preflop. You know, I think that's a standard raise. And so, but again, he knows this player better than I do. But I just, you know, a lot of people get caught up with the actual amount of the raise, but you got to be careful. If somebody's being consistent with it, then, you know, and that's why we want to be consistent, because we don't give away that information.
Now, before we move on to what he was thinking of, the player to his left was could possibly have now after this flop. What did you say exactly what you would have done after the 3,000 was bet?
Oh no, I didn't.
Yeah, what would you have done now with top pair, top kicker on this board, and a guy bets $3,000 into you?
Since I just called, I'm just going to call here.
Okay, you're just going to call.
Yep.
All right, so this is what he says now.
The reason is, you know, I don't think I'm going to get a better hand to fold. And I don't want to lose the hands that are weaker than mine. So I'm happy just calling. I'm not, you know, I don't feel great just because I hit the queen. You know, they still could have, this is important because, you know, we know that he may have a wide range, but Also, if he has two jacks, he's going to fold, and we don't want two jacks to fold. It's not likely he has the flush draw. It's certainly possible he could have like ace, king of spades, but they're not going to fold that hand either. So these hands that have us beat or, you know, any kind of draw is not going to fold with starting this with 40 big blinds, especially as the aggressor. So we're just not going to get those hands out, and I think we need to exercise a little pot control here.
So let me ask you this now to get to that point then. When he said why he thought the under the gun plus one player was betting out was to protect against a flush draw, it could have been. And then you were mentioning too that we're betting because the range of the button could easily have 4 or 5 in his hand. Knowing that, as you, Lee Childs, in this middle position now, or in between these two players, do you, if you believe in your heart, this guy behind you does have 4 or 5, still call? Or do you want to knock him out
now? That's way too late. I'm not saying he has 4 or 5. I'm not even going to think, like, okay. Uh-oh, he's got 4 or 5, so I need to... Because I don't know. If he's got 4 or 5, he may not fold anyway.
Right.
You know, so why go ahead and get it all in there? You know, I'd rather get... Because if he has 4 or 5 and I just call, he's probably just going to call. Okay. And, you know, I just want to trust myself post-flop here, you know, and realize I've just got one pair in a three-way pot. So, I'm not worried about this. I'm not as worried as Ryan is about this player because... I don't know what they're going to do. This is the hard thing about playing out of position.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of fearing the monsters under the bed. Like, you know, just this person's aggressive or loose. And so I'm not really worried about him because if I'm going to raise here, I need to be, you know, raising for value. And I think I'm in a way ahead or way behind situation here. And if I'm behind, you know, I got to feel like I have to hit a queen or an ace, which, you know, that may or may not be good, but that's almost the only way that I'm going to feel real comfortable here. I don't think you're going to get worse hands to come along if you raise.
Okay.
So there's really not a lot of value in taking this down right now.
So there's no protection on your mind here. You feel like you want to keep the pot at a reasonable size so that you can make a much better judgment on the turn than being worried that some guy has a straight draw and it gets there on the turn, or a flush draw and it gets there on the turn, because either way, no matter what you do, you're probably not going to get that person out. And then if the person in the under the gun plus one has kings or aces and now you raise, you've lost that extra money and that chance to see the turn because he can now come over the top again and shut you out. Is that sort
yeah
of what
I mean
thinking?
Yeah, because I think this player, the loose aggressive player, isn't going to fold a straight or flush draw. So regardless, if they have either one of those draws, they're going to come along. If I just call, they're just going to call. If I raise, they're probably still going to call. Yeah. And I'm more worried about, you know, being in the way ahead, way behind situation against that first player. And if I'm way ahead, then, you know, maybe they have jacks or tens, or maybe they've got ace king, and, you know, they just have very few outs if I'm ahead, and I have very few outs if I'm behind. So yeah. This isn't a spot to get all my chips in.
Okay. Well, he says the player to his left now, the crazy person, she could have anything. She plays a lot of hands and is not afraid to put money in the pot on all sorts of draws and low hands. If she had a big pair or ace-queen, ace-king, ace-jack, or similar, she would have re-raised preflop. I decide she might have hit a low card or was just on a flush draw. So I go all in.
Okay, well, that's how can you have that? You have no information on this
to narrow that hand range down. Exactly.
There's nothing. I mean, yeah. she could have pocket tens. She could have pocket deuces. She could have 8-4 offsuit. There's no information. The only thing we know is that she had a hand that she wanted to call on the button, and it's 100% of her range still at this point because the action isn't even on her.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. then the reason he gives is. The reason he goes all in is to get the girl on my left to fold her flush draw.
Okay, back up.
So how do we know?
She plays a lot of hands and is not afraid to put money in the pot on all sorts of draws and low hands.
Yeah.
So if she's not afraid to put money in the pot, then she shouldn't fold if she has those draws.
Exactly. And of course, how do we know she has that anyway? I mean, that's the other thing, too, is he's put her on a range with no action or any information at all. And just narrowed it down to absolutely flush draw is why I'm shoving here.
Yeah, it's just too narrow. Like that's certainly in her range, and it's just way too narrow. But I think the thing is, like, it sounds like he would also expect her to still call there with those hands.
Right.
So if you did, if something, I don't know, maybe her left eye twitches when she flops a flush draw, then just call and let her call and don't put a chip in if that flush draw gets there and then her right eye twitches.
He goes on to say, I can't be afraid of monsters. C10 having ace, ace, king, king, or low set. I figure I am ahead here, and if he calls, it is a good spot to more than double up. If he folds, I win a decent pot.
So if he calls, see, he's not going to get
called. He's not going to call you with a worse hand than
the only thing is maybe he calls with king, queen, or queen, jack, but I think king, queen is about the only hand that we're beating that he's going to call with.
Yeah, unless it's a flush draw, but even then, I don't know if he...
Yeah, and, you know, and if he's got ace, king of spades, then, you know, he does have an ace, so it's not really a true flip, but, you know, it's
kings or spades.
He's still got a lot of outs. I mean, he'd have the right price to get it in there on the flop.
So I think a lot of the trouble Ryan's having in his hand is his thought process. It's not necessarily whether he had the right cards or played the right cards or whatever, but it's more of his thoughts that are leading him to his decisions that are probably just not as solid as they should be to get him in the right position to win money here or to win pots.
Yeah, I think the two key things so far are just, you know, realizing that, you know, just calling with ace queen in general, if you're calling bets or calling raises preflop with ace king, just assume that's wrong. you want to be raising or re-raising with those types of hands. And against an earlier position player, I'm more likely to fold it. Against a later or mid-position player, I'm more likely to raise it. You know, I don't. If I'm calling now, you know, when I call, that's when my cards become, you know, more. I'm more dependent on my actual cards, and you don't want to be doing that with your bigger hands. So, you know, I think the decision preflop, and then, you know, then really, this is something that's helped me a lot, and something I've really focused on even more lately is those way ahead or way behind situations. You have to think, what's your purpose for your raise here? You know, and it's kind of backwards. Like his he's kind of thinking through a lot of the right stuff, but he's coming to the wrong conclusions, because if he shoves here and this player does have a draw, she's probably going to call. And also at the same time, if he shoves and takes the pot down, okay, that's great. Like, he probably wasn't going to win anymore anyway if the player had like two jacks or two tens.
Right.
You know, the player's probably going to just check and fold. So you've got to, in those way ahead, way behind situations, you know, you have to have a reason for betting. Can you get a better hand to fold? And can you get a weaker hand to call? And the answer to both of those is no here, unless they specifically have king, queen, which if they are kind of solid, they might be able to fold it and be afraid that you've got a set or you do have an ace, queen, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, so he says the woman to his left thinks for just a few seconds and folds. So clearly didn't have the flush draw, probably. C10 thinks for a solid 2 minutes, almost folds, then calls and says, I hope you have ace-queen. Not a good sign. Oh, man. So pocket kings for our razor preflop. Board runs out and we get no help. Had him covered by 500. We're out of the tournament. So he says, what about this hand could have made me believe he had king-king? That small preflop raise to build the pot? And I don't see why his raise was we brought this up already, was a bad raise. I think it's the right raise you want. You want to raise enough that there's some money to play for, but you might narrow the field. And 2.5, it's more than 2.5. I mean, that's plenty big enough for a raise.
Yeah, I mean, this is the type of thing that I love about our, you know, our trainings and doing the hands-on sessions, you know, where we talk about, because you get to probe into more of these questions, you know, that, you know, when he says it's a small preflop raise, sounds like that's uncharacteristic of this particular player.
Yeah.
It's obviously not a small preflop raise based on what would be a standard raise here. But, I think the main thing is that it's not – you don't necessarily have to believe he has king-king. It's that he raised an early position. So that's the first thing. You know, ace-queen needs to be the bottom of our standard range in early position. So if he's raising an early position, you know, that doesn't mean that's, you know, what he's really going to raise with. But You know, sure, you're going to mix it up. Maybe pseudo connectors and other pairs, and you know, and other aces at time from time to time. But just a standard range, and if you think they're pretty solid, then really your ace queen, ace jack should be kind of the bottom of the range. And you know, say it's even ace 10. Well, then based on the range of hands, pairs and aces from ace 10 up, your ace queen plays horribly against this range.
Yeah.
You're only flipping with some of the hands, and you've only got two hands dominated. So your hand is just not doesn't play well against their range. So that's why, you know, against the early position raise, I'd lean towards folding. But you know, I think believing he had kings, well, yeah, that's in his range for raising early position, and by just putting in 2,500 raise preflop, if you're going to play it, then when this, and now if this player flats him, now he's in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, because you're going to go with the hand there. But say the guy four bets him, then it's an easy fold with the ace queen. But I think if I three bet and this player was savvy enough to just flat me here, knowing that all hands other than, you know, aces are probably going to fold if I four bet. So, you know, I think if he flats me, I probably go broke on this hand.
Right.
Based on the stacks. And, you know, then it's just going to be too hard to put him on a hand that, you know, I'd have to give him maybe the flush draw with the suited connector. And then if he check raises me on the flop, I'm going to go broke. But, you know, and this is why we don't want to play this hand passively as well. It's just going to, you know, if played correctly, most cases he's going to lose, you know, between 2 and 2,500. And he's not going to have to play for stacks here. And at the point that he decided to play for stacks, he, you know, put the chips in where he's only going to get called by those big draws, maybe by that one player, and then the good player is just going to fold. So, you know, he just got himself in a pretty tough spot and bad situation.
Yeah, and the continuation bet, too, tells me that that's a bet kings would make. I mean, I would think that's a bet that kings would make because he's hoping you're coming along with king, queen, or you know, even ace, queen preflop. When he made his preflop raise, he's begging the poker gods that you have ace, queen, and betting $3,000 to not only protect his hand, but to hope that he gets up against ace, queen gets frisky and loses the stack. So like you said, if you just folded ace, queen, or if you had raised ace, queen preflop, you could have gotten away from this hand if this guy wasn't savvy enough to just call. He probably would have four bet, and you could have gotten away from it, and you'd still be in the tournament. So ace queen is in the number one edict of Doyle Brunson. Don't go broke with a queen in your hand.
Yep.
You know? All right, well, Ryan, you've been on the show numerous times, so we have no swag for you this week, but we do have a swag for anyone else who sends it in. A deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Annie Up. You can pick up your own decks at AnnieUpStore.com. Now, I know you're probably putting the training on hold for till the World Series and that whole time is over, right?
I think so. You know, I actually may do a session out there and am thinking about, you know, making myself available for some people that want to do some one-on-one stuff. I've talked with one guy who's got a place I could use for a group session. The trick is finding a time where I can commit to the time ahead of time, you know, because of my playing schedule. And I had one day, which is on the 16th, that I was considering doing it, but that didn't work for this particular guy. So that's may end up going ahead and coming back when I was supposed to that week. But yeah, I may do some stuff via web conference or just one-on-one out there with folks. But as far as the group sessions, most of them probably won't be until I get back, and I'll likely have a session or two here in the D.C. area, and then back at Borgata in September with several other guys, and it should be really good. Man, it's been awesome. We've just had so many success stories out of these classes.
Yeah.
And it's been weird because it's I know some things. I know why it's working, but it's been, you know, such a higher percentage of people than, you know, in the past and from you know, some of the other camps that I've done. But we've changed some stuff of how we're doing the hands-on, and you know, and I'm drilling into a lot of things where, you know, rather than, you know, I need to make sure that people have the fundamentals solid, and you know, I still do a lot of mindset stuff because I really think mindset is just so important. It's at least half the game. But you know, other things regarding preparation and then the hands-on stuff that we're doing, I just, every session we've had multiple people with ridiculous results. Speaking of the bar leagues, we had Lady came to the class I did at Borgata with Jason Young and Gavin Smith, and she lives actually in my area here, and so she came to one of the sessions I did here afterwards, and she plays in a bar league tournament, and since our class, she's played it 9 times, and she's made the final table 7.
Oh my God.
With 4 wins in 3 seconds.
Oh man.
And she went up to like somewhere in Indiana and final table to tournament, but she's on fire, and it's 100% because of the class. There were so many little things she didn't know. And, you know, and here's an example of where she's, you know, playing against predominantly inexperienced players. And a lot of people think, oh, I can't beat these idiots because they don't fold, you know. But she's, you know, adapting correctly to it, and, you know, and picking some spots. And, you know, we've got a lot of things where we talk about and demonstrate, you know, where the cards don't matter. And, you know, I think those and the way that we're presenting them in our hands-on sessions, you know, it's one thing to talk about it and people say, oh, yeah, I know I need to play in position. Oh, yeah, I know my cards don't matter. And, you know, but when we illustrate it hand after hand, you know, and I like it because it kind of makes some people think when we say that we're just going to play this crazy loose aggressive style, and it's really not that at all. It's picking the right spots, and we're helping people do that. And you know, I'm loving it. You know, I've been talking to a friend of mine. He said, you know, he was complaining because I had capped my class and the one I was doing here because I didn't want more than 15 people. And he's like, well, let me ask you, are you teaching to make money or because you want to help people? And I just laughed and I said, honestly, I want to help people get better. And he's like, you need to open up the class. You need to get more people. It's about the money. And, you know, while I've got to, you know, account for the time, and, you know, what I like to tell people is, you know, that this, the time and the money you spend on the class, you know, the information that I'm going to give you and the other pros will give you during these sessions, it costs me way more than $500 to learn that information. You know, this is time and money that I put into the game. I put into thinking about, you know, how to present it. And it's, I don't have all the answers, but I have spent a lot of time and a lot of money online and live tables. And I've had the, you know, I've been fortunate enough to play against some of the best players in the world, and playing in everything from, you know, $65 nightly tournaments up to, you know, 10K buy-ins and against a wide range of opponents. So, you know, I just really like being able to help people shortcut their time and investment. And those that are getting it and really taking it to heart, and they're putting this stuff to work. It's been just story after story that we've had, and it's been really cool. So I'm looking forward to doing more of these, and sucks that I'm not going to be on that next cruise, but it's going to be a good time to have some time off. It's right before the Borgata, so I'll be ramping up to do training and play the events there.
Okay, well, tell our listeners real quick how they can find out more information about both the Inside the Minds and your other training.
Sure, yeah. Inside the Minds, we have a Facebook page. That's facebook.com/InsideTheMinds. I've also recently got the shell and a little bit of information on inside-the-minds.com. So it's Inside the Minds with the dash in between the words.
Right.
And you can contact us at info@InsideTheMindsWithTheDashes.com or through Facebook. I've got my company, Acumen Poker. I'm deciding whether or not we're just going to – it's getting kind of hard to say, hey, I'm the guy that does the training with Acumen Poker and Inside the Minds. So I'm thinking about just using Inside the Minds for most of what I'm doing right now, and that's what we've been doing with these local sessions. But, you know, that's acumenpoker.net, and it's probably pretty outdated. But, you know, you can contact us either way. I think the best way, and for me directly, lee@insidetheminds.com is a good way to get me. But the info will go to me and to Kelly, my business manager, and we'll be posting information. There's also on Twitter,
right.
It's Inside the Minds. My Twitter is just Lee Childs, and of course, Acumen Poker is that one too. But most of the information will come from Inside the Minds and Lee Childs from Twitter. And just contact us, let us know. You know, we're open to going to different areas too. I've had somebody, I saw you mention you're going to be at Blackhawk. I had somebody on Facebook asking me to try to come out there. And, you know, I'm definitely open to going other places, at least for the rest of this year. I think the only casino we'll be doing it at is Borgata, but we may do it at some casinos. Or, you know, when I'm doing it local here, I'm just getting a conference room at a hotel, and we have the table set up. It's a nice setup for small groups of 10 to 20 people. And I'm just having a blast doing it and look forward to doing some more work with people.
Well, thanks for filling in today. I think that you did more than admirably filling the rather small shoes of Scott Long. And I think people may have actually forgotten who he is after these 2 weeks. So
at least I didn't have to fill his hat. I have a big head.
And apparently next week I'm going to be in Somalia or something. I don't know. I think Scott was telling me they're booking me a trip or something. So maybe
I will be in Vegas, my friend. I will be on the plane in about 24 hours from right now. I'm
excellent.
Excited.
Well, make sure you have a great, successful trip out there so we can hear all about it. And, of course, we'll meet up when we're out there to see you. And don't forget to write your column for me some point between now and next week if you can.
All right, you got it.
I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Lee Childs.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.